When I first started meditating in the 70s and exploring spiritual paths, and particularly the Buddha Dharma path, at that point I would say I most wanted to learn about freedom. And I wanted to unlock the mystery of suffering. And I might also say I was looking forward to directly experiencing the nature of reality. And I have learned some of that and experienced some of that. But what I didn't realize then was how much I was going to learn about love. And what I didn't know then is that the true nature of reality is love. Martin Luther King said, "Unconditional love is the key to ultimate reality." And when I started teaching Dharma full-time a few years ago, I didn't know then that I would discover that what I would call the withholding of self-compassion in students is actually, I think, the biggest obstacle on the path. The biggest obstacle for Westerners, anyway, on the path. And that this withholding of self-compassion is what actually keeps people stuck and limited and inhibited from what I might call the natural flowering of awakening. So self-compassion is just not, you know, a good idea. It's not just a side benefit of our practice. But I would say it's the very foundation on which our practice and the possibility for transformation lies. Otherwise, we spend years tangled up in our daily conflicts and struggles and resistance with ourself. And we spend years simply reinforcing patterns of judgment and rejection, comparison and blame, inadequacy and deficiency. And all of these habits or tendencies then become part of our identity, our self-image, and kind of we create a core sense of a solid self around them. And when I work with people, I see this over and over again. So one form of love comes in a variety of forms, but one form of love is this compassion. It's a word you hear a lot in Buddhism. And compassion, you could say, is simply the empathy that one feels in the face of suffering. It's the empathy, the experience of being moved, of being touched by the experience, by the presence of suffering. And responding with what I might call a meaningful tenderness or an impulse towards kindness. The first noble truth in Buddhism, which most of you hopefully are familiar with, is that life has suffering. And the Buddha's quest was to find out what does it mean to live in a world with suffering of all kinds. How do we meet that suffering? What is it? What is the suffering? How do we find freedom with the suffering? And our ability to experience compassion, our ability to bring compassion to all of our experience is essential for meeting this life that we find ourselves in here. This compassion is essential. To be able to live life with this inherent suffering on a daily basis and in ordinary circumstances. And the starting point has to be meeting our own suffering with compassion. And as I said before, this is essential. This is essential for freeing our heart. And freeing our heart is what liberation is about. So this response of kindness, this response of love, is really what I would call the conduit for connection. A moment of kindness is a moment of connection. And connection dissolves our illusions of separation and the rigid borders of ourself. And it dissolves fear. If you on some level at some times do not believe that you deserve love, and I run into this over and over again with people, then you will not, often you will not believe that others deserve love. And just as you don't offer compassion to yourself, you will withhold compassion from others. And the direction of our path, the direction of any authentic spiritual tradition, is towards the possibility of the completely open heart and the natural response of compassion to all suffering, no matter who or what or where. None excluded, especially yourself. So if you cannot fully open to yourself, how are you going to open to the moment? If you can't fully open to yourself, how are you going to open to the universe? So I invite you to start now. And you have moment after moment to practice. Each day, we have moments of different kinds of pain or suffering or difficulty, loss, disappointment, confusion, rejection, anger, discomfort, physical pain, anxiety, fear, shame, guilt, inadequacy, failure, exhaustion, shutting down, depression, reactivity, judgment. Any of these familiar? And are you familiar with how they feel in our body and our heart? So when these arise, these different moments of pain or difficulty, how do you respond to it? What is your habit of response? More self-judgment, self-criticism, repression, distraction. If you make a mistake, if someone's angry at you, how do you feel? What do you say to yourself? What do you do? How do you respond to these many moments of suffering? This is what the Buddha was interested in. Do you ignore and override, shut down? Do you have disgust? Do you blame yourself or others? Or are you ready to make peace with yourself? Are you ready to make peace with all aspects of yourself? Are you ready to make peace with the world? This is from Hermann Hesse. You know quite well deep within you that there is only a single magic, a single power, a single salvation, and that is called loving. Well then, love your suffering. Do not resist it. Do not flee it. It is your aversion that hurts, nothing else. So we have these so many opportunities to practice compassion. And this is your opportunity to start the training. As I like to quote Stephen Stills, if those of you know Stephen Stills, love the one you're with. And who are you with 24/7? 24/7. Year after year after year. There's some interesting research going on around compassion and self-compassion. And I want to allude to a little bit of that. Particularly, compassion has become a popular area of doing different kinds of studies and finding different kinds of information. And the Bay Area happens to be a hotbed of compassion research. At Berkeley and Stanford and other places as well. But self-compassion has had less attention. And one of the researchers who happens to be a Vipassana student and psychologist is Kristen Neff. She's in Austin, Texas. And she has written a book called Self-Compassion, which I recommend. And what she has discovered in a lot of her research and what she's been doing and investigating is the difference between self-esteem and self-compassion. And it turns out there's a big difference. And that's one thing I want to illuminate right now. And a matter of fact, self-esteem, as you may know, became the buzzword of education and lots of in psychology and lots of situations over since, I don't know, late 60s maybe. And unfortunately what they found is it's kind of backfired. From my viewpoint, authentic self-esteem is certainly a companion to self-compassion. But what has been promoted isn't what I would describe as authentic self-esteem. And it was hoped that raising people's self-esteem in schools and in education would be kind of the cure to a lot of the ills that society experiences. And actually, I looked up in the dictionary, one of the definitions of self-esteem is confidence in one's own worth and self-respect, which I think is a valuable and important quality. And something that comes also from self-compassion. But what also has been added on to it is self-esteem. Definition was also talked about being admired, being approved of, being seen as special. And this, unfortunately, has been part of the result of self-esteem, that it has encouraged people to look outward to be admired, to find approval, and to be seen as special. And this approach begins to encourage people to compare themselves to others and to see themselves in relationship to others, particularly better than others. Not only better than others, but the best. And it's also gotten related to perceived performance or competency. So people feel highest self-esteem when their performance or competency is well received, or they get feedback for that. So what has developed is what is called dependent self-worth. And we have created a culture, it's also called contingent self-esteem. A culture of contingent self-esteem. That means feeling good about yourself only when you're getting certain kinds of feedback, and also when you see yourself as being better than or the best. There's also a kind of addiction to self-esteem that seems to have arisen. And a culture of where average is not good enough. And I hate to tell you, by definition, most of us are average in most things. That's the definition, actually, of average. But what they find is that almost no one will admit to being average in the United States about anything. They may feel average or less than average, I don't know. But at least in what people will admit to. And if you look at yourself, you can see how being average is kind of an insult. Or we think of how I'm a failure if I'm average. And yet that's a no-win situation, isn't it? How can we all possibly be the best? And so this whole culture of not being good enough, which is extremely common. Again, that's, you just scratch the surface of almost anybody, and you'll see this lingering fear of not being good enough, this lingering belief that one isn't good enough. And one of the studies, which is kind of amusing, they asked people about their abilities in driving. And something like 95% of people said they're better than average drivers. And that included people who had recently had accidents that were their fault. So the more and more I have reflected on this since reading some of these studies is how pervasive and how destructive this view is, that our worth, we're not worthy as being just who we are. We're not motivated to express just our own sense of what's valuable, important to us. We're motivated to succeed and compete and prove ourselves to be better. And this feeds the treadmill of the self-improvement game, that one must always improve because one is never enough. And in some of the studies, they also found that people who rated high in self-esteem actually did, when they put people who rated whatever the test was, so they have low self-esteem and high self-esteem, they rated people who came out in those two categories. When they did these tests and put these people under pressure, under some kind of stressful situation, they actually, the people with high self-esteem did no better than the people with low self-esteem in terms of how they reacted, what their experience was, and how they felt about themselves. However, people who rated high in self-compassion were able to deal with the situation much better, and were in that sense that they had less difficulty, they were less judgmental, they moved through it more quickly, they were less frazzled or upset by it. This is a quote from Kristen Neff. Self-compassion does not try to capture or define the worth or essence of who you are. It is not a thought or label, a judgment or an evaluation. Instead, self-compassion is a way of relating to the mystery of who we are. Rather than managing our self-image so that it is always palatable, self-compassion honors the fact that all human beings have both strengths and weaknesses. Rather than getting lost in thoughts of being good or bad, we become mindful of our present moment experience, realizing that it is ever-changing and impermanent. Our successes and failures come and go. They neither define us nor do they determine our worthiness. They are merely part of the process of being alive. Our minds may try to convince us otherwise, but our heart knows that our true value lies in the core experience of being a conscious being who feels and perceives. So Some of the a useful way to consider self-compassion is to look at it as having three aspects. That we're developing three aspects: mindfulness, kindness, and common humanity. So we develop mindfulness, everybody here should know about that. And we develop mindfulness, that ability to recognize and open to exactly what we're experiencing right now, versus other habits of overriding, over-identifying, repressing, shutting out what we're experiencing. So we can't fully acknowledge or recognize or respond with compassion to our own suffering unless we actually feel it and know it and being willing to recognize it. The common humanity that we need to acknowledge, this is common humanity versus isolation or self-blame. And the common humanity is the recognition of our shared experience, of our interconnectedness, and that everything you feel is part of the human condition. Because so many of us, when we're feeling difficulty or unhappiness or pain, we isolate, we feel that it is us, or we self-blame. We are unique to this experience and it's worse. Or we're worse, or it's our fault. Or no one has ever gone through this but me, even if we rationally know otherwise. But in self-compassion, we connect over and over again with realizing our common humanity and really common sentience with all living beings. And then the third, the kindness. This is our capacity, which we all have, which is sometimes buried or has gone dormant, to actually respond with what I might call a warm, affectionate understanding and acceptance of our experience, rather than criticism or judgment. And there's a number of practices that I'm going to go through one of them with you here. There's a number of practices that can help with developing self-compassion, and a number of people here have been working with this in a variety of ways. And maybe when you have a little time at the end, you might share some of your experience with your development or your exploration and cultivation with greater self-compassion and the impact it's had. But a couple of things I work with people is certainly beginning to, the mindfulness piece of really becoming more aware of what one actually is experiencing and becoming very aware of our patterns of self-blame, of self-rejection, of self-judgment. All the ways that we are in conflict with ourselves, all the ways that we talk harshly and intolerantly with ourselves. And then there's practices of forgiveness, which I'm going to do next time, next week. Next week is going to be, I think, perfectionism, the gift of imperfection, and forgiveness. So working with forgiveness practices, self-forgiveness, and then what I call the benefactor practice, working with experiences and people that help you create a sense of being loved and a sense of receiving kindness. And then there's also phrases of self-compassion that one can use, and that's what I'm going to offer tonight. Many of you will be familiar with phrases, the loving kindness or metta practice that is part of this tradition. And these are similar to that. They've been modified a little bit. In working with people, I often have them develop their own self-compassion phrases, and there are some that you can adopt as well. So these are from Kristen Neff. And these phrases are really addressed, the mindfulness piece, the common humanity piece, and the kindness piece. So before I offer these to you and guide you a little bit with it, I want to say these are different than affirmations. Some of you are familiar with affirmations. Some of you may work with affirmations, and they can be positive and useful. And some people have what I call affirmation aversion. And there's one major difference between an affirmation and what we're doing. Anybody have a sense of what that might be? Some of you who might work with me will know what that is. Everybody familiar with the affirmations?
I never work with you, but it strikes me sometimes that affirmations really emphasize the I.
Well, that's true too, yeah. Mm-hmm. Any additional?
Well, I think they usually are saying things that you don't really believe to be true yet in the hopes that they'll become true.
Right. Right. Affirmations are not about what you're experiencing now.
Yeah.
They're about an agenda about what you want to experience. Which can have its value in certain times in terms of opening up and eliciting experience from you. But self-compassion and mindfulness is all about what you're experiencing right now. It's not about changing it into another state. It's about the willingness to experience right now and hold it in an embrace of kindness and openness and recognition and acceptance. And I just want to say, do not underestimate the power of doing that. Do not estimate the power of how that transforms you and what a gift that can become and what you can offer other people. So I'm going to do a short guided thing with you with this. And what I'm going to invite, I am going to invite you to feel something now by invoking it, if you can. And one way we do bring up feelings is to recall a situation, this is for practice, recall a recent situation that was painful to you in some way. Again, this practice is most powerful in the moment when something is being triggered, but we'll do it a little bit this way by practicing. So if there's something, the more recent, the better, the fresher, the better. Doesn't have to be a big thing. But again, I had this list earlier, which you should be able to pick something from. Loss, disappointment, judgment, inadequacy, discomfort, pain, depression, something, anger. And I want you to the best of your ability for this experiment, is what is called feeling the ouch of it, noticing if there is a feeling of pain, of contraction of the heart, of whatever form the ouch takes, the tenderness, the feeling of being wounded or hurt, whatever form, and actually not so much the story as much as what's that ouch feel like? And now I'd like you to add a small gesture of self-soothing, of self-touch. It might be your hands just touching each other, perhaps having that sense of one hand on, it could be a hand on your heart, could be just perhaps a slight embrace. Whatever, some sense of physical gesture of offering a soothing or kind, a warm, affectionate touch to yourself. Can be a small gesture. So feeling the ouch, inviting the gesture. Now I'm going to say the phrases and I want you to offer them to yourself. This is a moment of suffering. This is the mindfulness piece, just the acknowledgement. This is a moment of suffering. Suffering is part of life. This is the common humanity, the first noble truth. Suffering is part of life. May I be kind to myself in this moment. May I give myself the compassion I need. Remember, you're not trying to get rid of anything. You're actually acknowledging, witnessing, seeing its reality and shared experience, and then holding it in a field of this kind, accepting, understanding, self-affection. I'm going to say them again. This is a moment of suffering. Suffering is part of life. May I be kind to myself in this moment. May I give myself the compassion I need. So I'm going to add now to this a poem, and then I'll end this part of the talk. There'll be a few minutes for sharing and questions. This is from the poet Derek Walcott. Love after love. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving. At your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome. And say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself. To the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart, take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photograph, the desperate notes, peel your own image from the mirror, sit, feast on your life. Let's take a moment to sit just silently together.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.